Welcome back to Accelerando. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today I'm talking to master harmonica player and impresario, Mark Reisman. Mark is celebrating 50 years of music making, and he's inviting Pittsburgh artists to join him at the Thunderbird Theater in Lawrenceville for an evening of rock, blues, and soul. Sharing the stage with Mark will be Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers, Billy Price, Ernie Hawkins, and a lot of musicians he's played with over the years. I'll let Mark tell you all the details and more. We're going to be playing together at the Thunderbird in October on the 26th, and you've got this great lineup. So we've got Peter King. How did you first know him?
Peter came to review, I don't know, it might have been the last show for the Iron City House Rockers at the Decade, the former Decade in Oakland. And so he did a review. And I always like talking to the critics and the reviewers and anybody but the band because, you know, we were in vans for like 8 hours at a time and it's your brain just melts, you know.
Right, you need to change.
It's the lowest common denominator. And so I got to be friends with Peter. Well, Peter's a musician. He was writing songs. He's been writing songs forever. So eventually we started playing gigs together, and we've played many of them over the years. He has two albums. I think I'm on both of them. And I still play shows with him.
So then we have Ernie.
Ernie Hawkins, internationally known blues finger picker, pre-World War II acoustic blues. He's put out teaching videos and just really well known. And so I have no idea how I met Ernie. There's another one I don't remember besides you. How did I meet him?
That's right. We can't remember where we met.
I know.
We just remember like the second or third time we saw each other.
You're right. And so Ernie, I played a number of shows with him, including I went to Spain with him, where I've been many times to play. I did a couple dates over there, which was great. So John Binley puts on that Honky Tonk Jukebox show once a month, which is his band, Binley Hardware Company, backing up all these people from the country scene in the area. And, you know, a bunch of great musicians and singers, players. And
did you play with him in Bloomfield?
I did, most recently, yeah. They used to be over in the north side, the Teutonia Manor Choir room. Do you know where that is?
I might.
It's a big social hall.
Sounds like a big German place.
Yeah. Yeah, WDVE puts on a benefit Christmas show for benefit for Children's Hospital. I met him at one of those, and he asked me to play, and, you know, so I've played with him. Melinda and the Night Sky, that's Melinda Calese. She has Women Who Rock organization, which promotes breast cancer research. Her stuff is really blues rock. Her and her husband, you know, they're in their 30s. They love Prince, Led Zeppelin, the early Stones.
So they do a lot of covers of them?
No, most of it's original, but that's their roots. That's what they're working from. See, that's great for me because, you know, I grew up on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Bill Thompson, Hard Rain. And Bill, when I returned to the House Rockers, Bill was in the band. And so I played in the House Rockers, Joe Grushecki in the House Rockers with him for a couple years. He went out on his own, and I've played a lot with him since. So the first time I ever got on stage was with Billy Price in December of 1973. It was at a club that had music 7 nights a week in Shadyside and Ellsworth. When Shadyside was a lot, it was different, you know.
Yeah, there was the gazebo. And
the gazebo. Oh, there was a pizza joint that had music.
Yeah.
Plus, there was a head shop down in Ellsworth. That's where I bought my tickets to go to Woodstock.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't mean the reunion. I was at the original.
You went to the original. Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, I was a senior in high school. And
as pre-harmonica.
by like 4 or 5 years. Went with a friend. The store rented a bus. My mother drove me to the bus, you know, and we had no idea. That's the first time I saw Santana. I mean, you know, everybody was there. I mean,
oh my gosh.
It was just unbelievable. So I was really into music by the time I was a senior in high school.
When you first got on stage, it was with Billy Price.
Yeah.
And you just started playing harmonica, really,
yeah,
right?
maybe 6 months. What was the place called? The Fox. It's where Mario's was. They had music 7 nights a week. So they played there often. The Rhythm Kings, the band was called. And my sister was dating the drummer, so I would go down there a lot. You know, I didn't have a job and was trying to learn how to play harmonica, and my parents were ready to kick me out of the house by that point. And they did kick me out of the house, as a matter of fact. So one night, my sister Jan said to me, do you want to play with Billy? Because Billy would let, you know, musicians sit in. And I said, yeah, but I'm too scared to ask. And she said, come on. She took my hand, walked me up to Billy. They were on a break. And said, Billy, this is my brother, Mark. He plays harmonica. Can he play with you? And Billy said, sure. He says, let's see, why don't we do this song? I think it was a Jake Isles tune, Cruising for a Love.
And you always remember your first.
Yeah. And he said, we're in such and such a key. He probably said A, because that's the key I think it's in. And he said, do you know what key harmonica to use? And I said, yeah. And I turned out I didn't. And I got up there, and I was just, it was so intense. And it was like a 7 or 8-piece band, 3 horns and keyboard, and, you know, I was awful. I'm sure I was just horrible. And just got off the stage and was like, yeah, man, I'm doing this. This was such a high. Pretty soon, I mean, within that first year with, you know, spring, summer, I was in a band.
So what does it look like practicing as a harmonica player? You said you don't read music on the harmonica.
No.
You had training as a clarinetist when you were young. You
yes.
did like 5 or 6 years?
Private lessons, and I was in both junior high and senior high bands.
And did you like it?
Not really. The lessons, I hated the lessons, and my dad just wouldn't let me quit, and it was just awful. But of course, it was great, because it gave me an ear. The symphony used to have what they called young people's concerts. I went to all those, too. So I had all that.
So it was Woodstock one week and Pittsburgh Symphony the next.
Yeah, no problem.
So what did your first harmonica look like?
Well, it was a chromatic harmonica. That one was, I think, 12. But you can get up to 16.
And there's a little lever. What does the lever
do? When you push it in, it switches you off into a different reed. So it has the complete chromatic scale, depending on how many holes it is, in several octaves.
So if you press the button, you know, like we think of 12 notes, does it change it to a certain octave?
No. Without pressing that lever or button in, let's say you're playing a C. You press it in, you're playing a C sharp.
Like a harp. More. Like a harp.
Is it really?
And they have pedals.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And all the strings, you know, have 3 settings. It's basically sharp, natural, and flat.
Uh-huh.
It changes it from natural to sharp.
Yeah, it's going up half a step.
Does it go down the flat?
Well, yeah, you know, now we're getting some heavy music theory. Why would you...
If you wanted to play in the key of C flat.
It's all there, so yeah. If it's C flat, well, what's C flat? B.
Exactly.
So, I mean, what's G flat?
That's F sharp.
Yeah. F sharp. You know, okay. So you'd go to F sharp. So I didn't know what to do with that. That's the harmonica these two little kids sold me on a street corner.
Okay, so then you went and bought...
I bought a 10-hole diatonic blues harp.
And that one has 4 holes in the middle that make it a scale.
Well, there's a complete octave in the middle 4 holes, and then there are incomplete octaves on either side of that.
That's what blows my mind. You've got 4 holes and you've got a complete octave.
So
do you mouth it down, or?
Yes. So what are you going to do? So it's what a lot of the blues guys did. They played it in a way it wasn't meant to be played. So then you had to do bends. You had to bend the reed down.
So some of the sharps are just bent notes.
Flats. Yeah.
They're
I would
flats.
Call them flats.
Now they're flats.
Okay. Really, we call them blue notes. I don't know how to explain this. I mean, I'm a harmonica player. I think in terms of numbered holes. Because they're all numbered, you know, 1 through 10. You're starting the scale in a different place.
Like on fa instead of do.
Yeah. And then to get a complete scale, because now you're into a different scale, to get a complete scale, you're going to have to bend a couple notes down half step. I'm going to play draw 2, and then I'm going to play the same hole, but I'm going to bend the note into a blue note. There's some kind of physics about the interaction, because the reeds are stacked, the one reed above and one below, so that you can do that. Now, it gets harder and harder as you go up, because the reeds get shorter and shorter. So let's go up to draw 4.
Okay,
Then you get up to five, and that's usually, I guess that's about a quarter tone is what you can get out of that. And then draw six. So that's, yeah.
You can go half step.
Yeah, that's about half step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't need any of the black keys, basically.
I guess not, right. So up top, what I was talking about, I was bending on draw notes.
What's a draw note?
A draw note, draw in, blow out, okay? Bending notes on the top three or four holes. That's all blow. As you go up the scale, it's blow, draw. You're going up. Blow, draw, blow, draw, blow, draw. It flips so that when you get to hole seven, it flips to draw, blow to go up the scale. Don't ask. I have no idea why it does that. So then up top, you can blow bend the notes. So you get notes that really aren't on this instrument.
You have one with a letter name for each key.
Yeah, but I have duplicates because the reeds are made of brass. So they fatigue, and you never know when they might go.
So you have to have a backup.
Yeah.
Like it gets worn out, you know, it gets tired.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's the exact same harmonica, you just need two of them.
As you can see, there's a difference in the harmonica combs. This is customized. The comb's been replaced. They've screwed it down, which actually the way is Hohner is now making them. Pulled out the rivets. They've screwed it down so it's more airtight. And they've actually filed out the reed slots. And they've filed off all the sharp corners that you might find, that you used to find on these harmonicas. And this is a composite comb. It won't bend or swell. But out of the box, they were pear wood. And you'd play them for a while, and they would actually swell and cut your lips.
In your little box here, they're all 10 whole harmonicas.
Yeah.
And you have 21 of them.
Yep.
Three for each key.
No.
No. Two for each key.
Well, some. It really depends, and it would vary according to what band I play with. I know I'm going to use certain keys a lot more than certain others. So I just have, you know, one A flat. But then you get into this thing where this is pitched. This is a low F, so this is pitched an octave below. As you go up the scale of a harmonica, for practical purposes, the G harp is the lowest standard harmonica, so it's pitched real low. Okay, then you get up to F, which is... Okay, so it gets really screechy.
So you're going to the middle of the harmonica, and then you have to. Then it switches. You have to start blowing instead of blowing.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, which takes a while to figure out. Sometimes I'm able, you know, and it depends on the context and if it's a loud band or not. Well, you can get these low pitched harmonicas. Actually, these are custom built for me. So instead of the F sounding like this, real kind of screechy, it sounds like this. So this is F sharp, but it's still way below the screechy F thing. Yeah,
it's below G. You said G's the low one.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's below G's. So I actually have a whole set of these normal harmonicas.
So you have a whole bunch more at home.
Oh my God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like I have strings, you know? And it gets to the point, you know, because you have to replace your strings. You think, oh, these are worth it. I should save them. And then you have piles and piles of them. Do you have piles and piles of harmonicas at home?
Yeah.
Okay, and you have some much bigger ones, too, the one we call the cheese grater.
Bass harmonica.
You're going to be playing that on the show.
I'm going to be playing it, and you likely will never hear this anywhere in Pittsburgh, state of Pennsylvania.
Okay, who are you going to play the bass with?
On one of Ernie Hawkins' tunes. I'll probably play it on one of Bill Tom's tunes. And I actually have played bass harp on some of the House Rocker records. I have to memorize those parts. They're chromatic. The bass harmonica is chromatic.
As opposed to what? Reading the music?
Hearing it. Knowing where to go. Just because it's muscle memory, you know where you need to go. You know the relationship of the notes to each other.
Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers. That's the beginning of your career, wasn't it?
Actually, I was in four bands before I started with the House Rockers. They saw me playing in one of those bands, and they were looking to replace their harmonica player. So they approached me, and they hired me. They had done a demo tape of a couple of original songs. They were really into Bruce Springsteen, and there's another Jersey guy who's still playing, Southside Johnny, and the Asbury Jukes. So they sent a demo tape to the management company for Southside Johnny. And actually, Southside Johnny, a lot of the songs were written and produced by Steve Van Zandt in Springsteen's band. So there were all these connections. So they thought, well, you know, we're writing songs that are kind of like, you know, some of Bruce's things. That was one of the places they sent this demo tape. I joined the band and they got a call like a month later, and suddenly we're talking about a record deal. But I didn't care. I just wanted to play in a rock and roll band. Yeah, the band was called Brick Alley when I first joined them. Anyway, we got picked up. They started paying for us to go to a decent studio in Cleveland. We did these, what we really thought were better demos, financed by the management company. Next thing we know, they get a record deal for us with MCA, and those demos became the first record. And then the second record, we recorded in New York City at a great studio. That was co-produced by Steve Van Zandt, Mick Ronson, and Ian Hunter. Mick Ronson played with Bowie. And he's a guitar player. He played in that The Traveling Circus or something. He played guitar with Dylan. So these are heavy. Ian Hunter, all the young dudes, Mott the Hoople was the band. They had a huge hit with all the, which the song was written by David Bowie.
Did you get to play with all these guys?
What happened was, you know, we were rehearsing here, but we had a week to rehearse with the three of them in New York City before we started recording. So this is very interesting because it was like oil and water. I mean, Steve Van Zandt associated with Bruce Springsteen. Then the other hand, these British rockers. I don't think they ever
New Jersey and Britain. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think they were in the same room ever all at once.
Yeah.
They were helping us to arrange the songs. So we come in one day, and there were totally different attitudes about work. Steve Van Zandt would be, okay, get some good work done today. We're going to work on this song. Let's get going, figure out some ideas and whatever. Ian and Mick would come in and it would be way more low-key, relaxed. And what was happening was Van Zandt would actually come up with an arrangement on a song. And then the next day, we'd play it for Ian and Mick and they'd be like, eh, let's do something different with that. And that's how it started getting to the point where we got in the studio. I think Van Zandt withdrew within a few days. So, of course, most of the tracks were done, not mixed, but recorded. So there were rough mixes before I put my solos in or my parts. Mick is like, well, let's go out for a beer. You know, you want to go out for a beer? We're talking, and he says, well, you got to go in, make some really, you know, play some really good stuff tomorrow. Whatever you need. You want cocaine? You want whiskey? And I'm like, I just need a glass of water. And we were just kind of these hunky guys from Pittsburgh hanging out with, this is rock royalty. And really, we're kind of wide-eyed.
But some of it worked out?
Oh, that second album is the one that garnered just unbelievable reviews. And that really set our career on fire. We recorded the third record with Steve Cropper. Steve Cropper, you know, co-wrote Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, played in Booker T and the MGs. He was a guitar player in the Blues Brothers.
So did you ever play on the stage with Bruce Springsteen?
Many times. Yeah.
Yeah.
The first time was a little bar in New Jersey. It might have been called Cheers. Joe and I went up there for an acoustic show. And he says, oh, Bruce might be down tonight. I hadn't played with him before. I was absent. I left the band for a while and then came back. Bruce showed up, rode in on his motorcycle from his New York home. And we played a set, and then he got up and played a bunch of tunes with us. And it was really wild because by this time he had already produced a record for the band before I got back in the band. So he actually knew some of the songs.
He knew your songs?
Yeah.
So he sang.
And that's when you hear that voice, that's when you realize.
People are hitting their phones and telling everybody that Bruce Springsteen is down at Cheers.
Right.
Get down here. And then what happened?
Then he gets mobbed and he has to run out. Many times at the Stone Pony, I guess he played when he was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come down, and there was one night when actually he came down with his wife, Patty Scalfa, and Susie Terrell. She plays violin. They were all up on stage with us, and Bruce is ordering shots for everybody, and that was a wild night. That was really something.
Well, at least he wasn't offering cocaine.
No, he wasn't. There was never that. Thank goodness.
So how the heck did you get called for the Pittsburgh Opera?
Well, so I was teaching blues harmonica at the time at Calliope. They called Calliope looking for a harmonica player because there was harmonica in the score.
So they'd never heard of you and they didn't know that you were with the House Rockers.
No.
They just called Calliope.
Donna over at Calliope called me up and said, "Hey, Mark, they made an opera out of Grapes of Wrath and they're looking for a harmonica player for the opera orchestra."
So when you said yes to that, what did you think was going to entail?
I thought I'd be playing some blues and country music and some square dancing. Boy, there was one square dance.
There was one square dance, but it was like a two-hour opera. So how did you prepare for it?
I asked the manager for a copy of the score.
You practiced hours a day on that, I bet.
Hours a day.
They have no idea.
I'm not sure what they thought of my playing. But Ricky Gordon did sign a poster for me. He said to the great Mark Reisman, and I'm like, wow, do you really believe that? I don't think he really believed that, but...
To Ricky Gordon, maybe you improved it. Because if he wasn't writing for a harmonica player that plays in the way that you do, what was he writing for? He must have envisioned something, and maybe you took it to the next place.
Go with that story.
I know that we had a good time sitting there. Yeah, you're to my left, and I remember just being in awe of the array of harmonicas you brought in.
Yeah, I did. So I had a couple of chromatic harmonicas, which my custom harp builder had made for me. You know the difference between a good instrument and a great instrument. You know, it's just easier to play, sounds better. So I was working with 12-hole ones, easier to handle because, you know, they get longer and longer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all I needed for the score.
That was great. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a story that you add to your palette of experiences.
Right.
Did you talk about the Will Condridge Trio?
Will's, I guess he's 29 years old, and part of this whole project, it's not only a reflection of where I've been, I also wanted it to be a reflection of where I'm going, because I'm still playing.
Another 50 years.
Yeah, at least.
1973, you started. What was easier about the music business in 1973? Were there times that you walked into something that you would say that wouldn't happen today?
The nurturing of artists at that time by record companies and, you know, bringing them up and helping them to realize their potential. And so, you know, I mean, they would set you up like that.
It was brutal in a way, because if you didn't get signed, how did you make an album?
That's true. You basically didn't.
You didn't. So,
yeah.
So there's a couple of problems there. First of all, did you own your music? Second of all, they might say, we don't want your band. We only want you. And if you don't get asked, you don't get to play.
Yeah. Well, and so you're playing on a local level, and maybe you have some kind of a regional reputation, and, you know, bands would go into studios and do singles.
And demos.
Demos, yeah.
And then hope that the radio station picks it up, and then some talent scout might go find you out someplace. And that's what happened with you, right? You guys did a demo, and somebody picked it up.
Yes.
So that's how they did it back then.
Right.
So what do you think nowadays? Is the DIY better?
You could look at it in different ways because, you know, people are making records on their phones, you know, with software programs on their computers. Wasn't Billie Eilish recording in her bedroom? I mean, that first record is...
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that never could have happened back then. But I think what record companies, to the extent they're around still, they're looking for artists that have product and or some kind of reputation. It seems to me they're really looking for stuff that's more fully bloomed. Yeah, it still, you know, sucks in some way. I mean, we had a record deal. We toured. I think I kept the tax return. The most I ever made was $13,000.
Touring for a year.
So maybe if there's been, you know, even 50 or 100% inflation, so the most I ever made was, you know, in today's dollars, whatever, $25,000. Yeah.
So basically you can't be a professional musician only.
It's so difficult.
So you do something else.
That's right.
And you're a lawyer. That's right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I had a blues show on WYEP. WYEP was in a basement studio on, was it Senate Street? I forget. It was some little street in Oakland. And I remember some shifts I had to crawl in through the basement window to get in. And I had my box of records with me, you know.
So the key was not under the potted plant where it was
supposed to be. Yeah, where it was supposed to be, whatever, yeah. So I had a blues show for a couple years. And then I was in the house, I joined the House Rockers. So I was in a rock and roll band, brought in the bass player because punk rock and new wave was starting to become popular. And we flipped the show to a punk and new wave show. And that was the end of playing blues on the radio. It was great. I mean, the show started at 1 in the morning. It was a Tuesday night. And the Decade was having bands. I mean, U2 came through, The Police came through, The Ramones. What we did was we would go to the Decade, watch their show, talk to them afterwards, and invite them down to the show for them to be guest DJs.
Right, the after show.
Yeah. Some of the Ramones came down. Let's see, Talking Heads. Who else came down? U2. When The Police played, the guitar player and Stuart Copeland, the drummer, came down. That really was an amazing experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, WYP, I mean, it was 1 a.m. We just really did what we wanted to
do. You could do what you wanted
to
do.
Yeah, we had a great time.
Blues.
Shruti Blues, which is not really a blues song, but it was a melody that just came to me out of the blue. I'm going to tell you the story. There was no Shruti. There was just this melody, right? I didn't have a name for it. I played it into my iPhone. I was visiting the guy that builds my custom harmonicas, and he plays guitar, and he also plays harmonica, of course. I had most of it written, but I needed a bridge. So I said, you want to help me finish this song? And he's like, sure. So we sat down, and he's learning the chords for me, and we're playing it. And he said, you know what? Wait a second. He goes to another room. He comes back with a Shruti box, which I had never seen or even heard of. And he said, you know, this might sound good with this. I'm going to say it's kind of sort of like an accordion. It did sound good with it. And that's how it came to be called Shruti Blues.
Come down to the Thunderbird Cafe and Music Hall for the first 50 years. Harmonica master Mark Reisman is joined by Joe Grashecki and the House Rockers, Gil Snyder, Billy Price, Bill Toms and Hard Rain with the Soulful Horns. Also, finger picker Ernie Hawkins, Melinda Calaisi and Night Sky, John Bindley, Peter King, Rick Witowski, Don Hollowood, the Will Condridge Trio, and other special guests, including a cameo appearance by one of Pittsburgh Opera's cellists. It's October 26th at 7 p.m., and tickets are available at the Thunderbird's website, thunderbirdmusichall.com. Thanks for listening to this podcast, and if you liked it, please share it. And consider subscribing to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Amazon Music. There are show notes on the website at cellorondocast.com. Hope to see you at the Thunderbird, where live music will be in abundance, and we all could use a little more live music. Have a great week, and see you next time.